Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's a very funny saying in America by a guy, a baseball player called Yogi Berra. And he has a quote that says, when you come to a fork in the road, take it.
Yeah.
Which is very strange. But it's really beautifully, eloquently said. And I think I just naturally, gently followed wherever it seemed like I was supposed to wander. So you take polka lessons, which on the outside doesn't sound like a great idea.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a wonderful idea. This oompa, 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 oompa. And the different accents of the rhythm inside of that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you listen to No One Knows and it goes boom-ta, 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 boom-ta. You know, I see...
Yeah, indeed.
Boy putting polka and shoving it inside the husk of rock music.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu Der Soundtrack meines Lebens. Ich bin Jan Schwarzkamp und ich werde euch in diesem Podcast auf eine musikalische Reise mitnehmen. Eine durch das tönende und klingende Leben meiner Gäste. Mal nerdig, mal erhellend, immer persönlich. Ein Austausch über Popkultur im Allgemeinen und ein Blick aufs Leben durch die Linse der Musik im Speziellen. Viel Spaß mit der folgenden Episode. Zu Gast in dieser Episode von der Soundtrack meines Lebens ist Josh Omi und damit mein erster internationaler Gast. Nach dieser Einleitung werden wir unser Gespräch also auf Englisch führen. Omi wird im Mai 1973 in der Palm Desert in Kalifornien geboren. Er ist 15, als er 1988 die Band Caius mitgründet. Die werden zur Vorreiterband einer Szene, die man fortan als Stoner Rock kategorisiert. Nach deren Ende steigt er eine Weile als Live-Gitarrist bei den Screaming Trees aus Seattle ein. Aus seiner bis heute sporadisch aktiven Jam-Reihe, den Desert Sessions, entstehen 1996 die Queens of the Stone Age. Und mit denen veröffentlicht Omi zwischen 1998 und 2023 8 Alben, mit denen er die Band zu einer der spannendsten, eigenständigsten Rockbands der Gegenwart macht. Parallel agiert Omi in der Supergroup Them Crooked Vultures zusammen mit Dave Grohl und John Paul Jones sowie den Eagles of Death Metal, bei denen Omi seine geliebte Gitarre zur Seite legt und Schlagzeug spielt. 2016 kooperiert Omi mit seinem Vorbild Iggy Pop und schreibt ihm das Album Post-Pop Depression auf den sehnigen Leib. Im Anschluss gehen die beiden mit einer All-Star-Band auf Tour. Und jetzt freue ich mich, Josh Omi hier in der Soundtrack meines Lebens begrüßen zu dürfen. So, hi Josh, thanks for having me.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for
Sorry
having
for
me.
That I made you sit through this introduction.
No. It was very, very soothing, and I found it just very relaxing to listen to you talk.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Josh, you were born as a younger brother to Michael and Irene Omi in Palm Desert. And yes, it's in the desert. It's in the Coachella Valley, to be exact. There is not much around besides sand, hills, heat, and vast plains. And you grew up on your grandfather Clancy's farm, I guess. He was called Cap. What is your earliest musical childhood memory from these days?
His name was Cap. He lived on a street called Clancy Lane that was named after his dog, Clancy.
Okay. And,
I think my earliest memories of music is every once in a while we would drive in the summertime to northern Idaho and sometimes we would stop in Las Vegas. And I remember going to dinner theater and seeing, you know, showgirls and big band music. And if at that time, if you didn't have a dinner jacket, they'd give you one. So I would never bring a jacket just so they would give me an adult jacket. I think it was about 8.
Yeah.
And it made me feel very grown up, you know.
And then you saw burlesque shows of, I think that would probably be further than that.
I saw, you know, almost like, was normal to have a chorus line.
Yeah.
Right. Lots of kicks, lots of feather boas.
Yeah.
And then we would go see a comedian like Rodney Dangerfield. I don't know if
Rodney
that matters.
Rodney Dangerfield. Okay.
In fact, I think seeing Rodney Dangerfield was a big deal because he got booed off stage.
Yeah.
And I was blown away because I didn't realize the audience could get together as a group and boo, essentially saying, that's enough.
Yeah.
And then he walked off stage.
Yeah.
So I was just blown away that people on stage were susceptible to the audience.
Yeah.
They were at the audience's pleasure, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. But what music did your parents listen to? Was there music around at home?
Well, my parents listened to music in a strange way in that they would just listen to an artist's single record. And they would never listen to anything else.
Yeah.
And so my folks listened to, my dad saw The Doors in Washington, D.C. once on a trip across the country.
Yeah.
So I listened to a lot of The Doors, which I think is the first time I ever remember music being scary and mysterious.
The end.
And unknowable,
yeah.
You know? And I think it was, you know, the poetry that was there was so dark and mysterious. And I just thought, oh my God. Uh-huh. And I think taking these long drives to, you know, like 1,000-kilometer drives, listening to a cassette tape, just flip and then start again.
Yeah.
I really got a chance to examine records and almost deconstruct them, or so walk closer to the source of them, I guess, and feel like you're seeing the nucleus of the music and standing right next to it. And so listening to The Doors, or there was a record called Running on Empty by Jackson Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no way of realizing it, but it's an entire record recorded on the road.
Yeah.
About being on the road and living your life as a traveling musician.
Mm.
And even the cover is just a road that goes off into nowhere infinitely.
Uh-huh.
And so I sometimes think how strange it is that that's what I have fallen into doing.
But your brother, he's a little older than you. Did he have a certain musical influence on you?
That's a well-researched question. My brother was really into Depeche Mode, The Cure, Erasure, you know, bands like that, Berlin, the band Berlin.
Yeah.
And I really loved his musical taste. Mm-hmm. I think when I was younger, I couldn't admit that.
Yeah.
Because when he started being able to buy his own music, that's what he went to.
Yeah.
But also Duran Duran, which is a band I love.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was too busy buying Misfits records and, you know, The Cramps The English Subhumans and GBH and Discharge. And
we will come to all that. But let me ask first, did the radio or MTV play any role in young Josh's life?
MTV started, I remember when it started, and they did play things like this. I heard about NXS.
Yeah.
And those first NXS records I really love too. So I think because I was already buying my own music when that came out, I was sitting watching MTV desperate for something punk rock to show up. Anything that even, that's how I got into the Pretenders and things like that.
Yeah.
Because it was like, these are punk rockers. This is sort of punk rock. Yeah, this is like, So it was close enough for disco, as I would say.
Okay. But at a very early age, and before I think you felt a hunger for punk, you saw rockabilly pioneer Carl Perkins at the Sandpoint Music Festival in Idaho. You already liked Elvis Presley and somehow found out that Perkins wrote Blue Suede Shoes.
Oh my goodness, so you know a lot.
So the first record you bought was Carl Perkins, right?
It was the first record that was sort of given to me because I talked about Carl Perkins so much to my parents that they just gave me, you know, they had a record player that they never used.
Yeah.
And so I just asked if I could take it. And then here was this Carl Perkins record, because when I saw Carl Perkins, I was so little, you know, I didn't understand. I never considered how music came to be. Mm-hmm. So the idea, I'd heard Elvis, I thought Elvis was handsome and spectacular. Mm-hmm. And like I early on heard his cover of, or his version of Blue Moon.
Yeah.
And it's just so innocent and beautiful and sweet. And again, not too dissimilar from The Doors. It was kind of scary somehow.
Yeah.
The loneliness of it.
Yeah.
And so hearing Blue Suede Shoes done by Carl Perkins, realizing he had written that song, was a window into you could write songs and other people could perform. I mean, I had no way of knowing that was possible.
How could you? Yeah. But I've heard that Perkins actually made you want to pick up the guitar, but at first you wanted to play the drums, and your parents denied that wish.
Well, you
Why
sure
is
know
that?
A lot. Boy, I'm surprised I've said all this. Yes, you know a lot. Yeah, I used to play with chopsticks or a fork and a pen and you know, and when you're learning, it just sounds like tapping to other people. But they had no way of knowing that I was playing things I heard.
Yeah.
And even though it turned out that those were songs that I heard, I was playing the songs, you know, almost phonetically.
Yeah.
You know? So it just was always that I always gravitated to music because it seemed like it was just always there.
Yeah.
And that it's almost like opening a door in your home and saying, oh, hi, music, my name is Joshua, you know? And just, it was a thing that just seemed to be there.
Yeah. When you were 9 years old, you got yourself your own electric guitar. It was an Ovation Ultra GP.
Yeah.
In a Sandpoint music store.
So I think it was a little bit older than that. I think it was probably a... Boy, I'm not good with time. I probably was 11 years old because I really, the first records that I bought when it was my choice, was in a Tower Records in San Diego. And they say, don't judge a book by its cover. But I don't know if I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you get a chance to pick your own cover, you're definitely attempting to say something.
Mm-hmm.
Or as my friend says, don't judge a book by its cover is what people with a shitty cover always say. Anyways, I picked The Cramps, Off the Bone, Misfits, Legacy of Brutality. I picked a Stooges record, Raw Power, which I couldn't understand at the time. It was too scary, basically.
Yeah.
It was too wild. I didn't understand... musicians could display their wildness.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was possible.
Uh-huh.
You know?
I was just wondering, how did you finance that first guitar that you bought? Did you worked on your grandfather's farm, right?
Well, I worked on a farm that was throwing bales of hay and working. It was a little tree farm, which... Later on, I've always had a fascination with tree farms because they're so natural and yet they're so unnatural because they're grown in the most unnatural way, but here is this natural thing.
Yeah.
So anyways, by the time I'd bought this Ultra GP, this Ovation, I was already deep into Black Flag. Greg Ginn had... He always played the same guitar, Greg Ginn being the guitar player of Black Flag.
Yeah.
And he was sort of the leader of Black Flag.
Mm.
And because they changed singers, but it didn't matter.
Yeah.
Right. So, and he had this same guitar all the time. And so, you know, the influence I got was find your own thing and claim it to be yours.
Yeah.
And that felt good because it felt like the music was that way too. Now, ultimately, all I was doing was he had his own guitar, so I got mine own too, which isn't much of a original idea.
Which, weirdly, I think your guitar teacher, he was totally into polka. And I mean, in how far did that circumstance form your style of playing?
Well,
because at first I think you were heavily into picking, right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't own a pick, so I had no choice but to be heavily into picking. And I suppose in hindsight, I see how I just sort of gently followed. You come, there's a very funny saying in America by a guy, a baseball player called Yogi Berra. And he has a quote that says, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Which is very strange, but it's really beautifully, eloquently said. And I think I just naturally, gently followed wherever it seemed like I was supposed to wander. I really... Mm-hmm. So you take polka lessons, which on the outside doesn't sound like a great idea.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a wonderful idea. This oompa, 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 oompa. And the different... the different accents of the rhythm inside of that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you listen to No One Knows and it goes boom-ta, 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 mm-hmm. boom-ta. You know, I see...
Yeah, indeed. I see a
boy putting polka and shoving it inside the husk of rock music.
Yeah.
And I think that's just fine. It just felt like there's a way to do all things. Uh-huh. There must be a way to do all things, you know.
There's a record store in Palm Desert running since 1978, the Record Alley, situated in a mall. And that's where you started buying your first records, right?
I bought my first purchase was in San Diego. And, and from there, you know, I think it's so American for an American kid to spend his time at the mall or her time at the mall.
Yeah.
It's just some rite of passage.
And it's less hot in there than outside.
Oh my God. So skateboarding through the heat, melting wheels and shoes.
Yeah. You don't want that.
I mean, and it's also in America, it's the first place you go where your folks ain't there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You meet your pals and yeah, so records were very cheap. They were only a couple dollars. Mm-hmm. And so it allowed me that chance to follow judging the album by its cover.
Yeah.
You know? And they had this incredible, they're closed now, which is a shame, but I think of how many lives they impacted.
Yeah.
Because guys from the desert and gals from the desert that are really talented, that was their only source of...
To the outside world, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there was no Los Angeles to us. I didn't even know where the hell that was.
Yeah, I mean, Los Angeles is a 3-hour car ride away, and you didn't have cars. You could have taken a bus.
My recollection is I don't recall ever being in Los Angeles till the first time I played there.
Yeah.
There was one memory of driving over the Sunset Strip that has nothing attached to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm.
One of the first albums you bought, or two of the first albums you bought, is The Exploited with their 1984 live album On Stage.
Yeah.
And the other
pink,
is...
I have the pink album, the pink version of
pink
it.
Pink vinyl,
It's a limited edition.
But why did you pick it? Did you already knew about The Exploited, or were you just like, did you just like Watty's haircut, or...?
I mean, I had no magazines or... information, or obviously there's no internet, you're just grasping in the darkness.
Yeah.
And you know, they had a basic general look like the Cramps and the Misfits,
and
they looked wild. I mean, the cover is Waddy, the singer, a pink mohawk, this pink pressing I had.
Yeah.
And to see someone with a mohawk was so exciting and terrifying. What choice did I have? Plus, when you hear the music, it's so raw.
Yeah.
And even though I was taking polka lessons, I was like, I can play this. Exploited Barmy Army.
Yeah.
Also, interestingly, if you take a song like Exploited Barmy Army, it's a tribal song. So much of the Exploited is so tribal because it's a drum beat that repeats. It goes, and so it's just this repeat, but it's not a simple beat.
Yeah.
It's a longer idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that made sense to me because when I was playing on trash cans with a fork and a pen. Mm. That's what I was like, that idea of creating a song percussively before you add anything else, mm-hmm. It's just important to me.
There was another record that you bought, Eastern Front, a punk compilation.
Another Mohawk on the cover.
Another Mohawk on the cover, and also a good opportunity to get to know a couple of bands and not only one.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a lover of compilations. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's how can you not like compilations? There are somebody curating a bunch of people, and those people said, if we're going to take one song, we'll take this one and put it on.
Yeah.
It's the sonic best foot forward, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. so clear. So compilations, was the only way to like all of a sudden to like fan out your understanding of music.
And sometimes they were cheap because it was also promotion for a certain label, for example.
Yeah. But you realize that later.
What they have.
You realize that later on because you start, you know, I guess when your view is so small when you are small, and as you sort of rise up as, you know, and look at the earth from higher and see your place in it. You know, the more you push and follow your inspiration like that, the more your vision is exposed to things, you know. Yeah.
And then think about the Nuggets compilation. I mean, nobody would ever be able to gather all those rare singles, but having them all in one place.
Thank the Lord they did that.
Yes.
Well, that realization of the Cramps.
Yeah.
That half their music or more is covers.
Yeah.
And so lovingly, you know, caressingly played by the Cramps.
Yeah.
Such dirty motherfuckers. The Cramps covering her song would be one of the greatest honors of that could ever exist, you know?
We will talk about the Cramps in any minute, but at first, at the age of 11, you bought Raw Power by the Stooges, but it was too much for you to handle.
Yeah.
So you traded it.
It was in that first purchase. Yeah. It was too much. I was like, what is this? It was too much for my fragile little mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Little did I know what it would become for me.
And you traded it with a compilation by the Cramps called Off the Bone.
Mm. No, I bought it in that first purchase.
Okay.
But I ended up trading it for ironically, for an album by an Italian. I don't know if that's right.
Okay.
Well, fuck it, I'll say it anyways, as if it were right.
Yeah, okay, do it.
I think I traded it for an Italian hardcore band called Raw, and their Raw Power was what they were called. Not realizing that it was... I believe I traded that Raw Power for Raw Power.
That is...
Not even seeing the influence as perhaps a nine-year-old.
Yeah. But at some point, you at least got the Cramps compilation Off the Bone, and you embraced the Cramps. As a B-side, the Queens covered The Most Exalted Potentate of Love at some point.
Yeah.
The opening track of that Cramps 1983 mini album, Smell of Female. What did you like about the Cramps?
I love that. First of all, I felt like there's probably a huge swath of the population that does not like this band. Mm-hmm. And that would be somewhere between disgusted and afraid of them. And I liked how that made me feel. Mm-hmm. It made me feel that I was part of something small that was passionate.
Yeah.
I think the way they looked and the way they played, they had no bass player but they played sort of in a way that made you feel like they were saying, bass player, I don't understand what you mean. Like, so what? You know, I loved... In my mind, the way they sounded, the way they could snarl but be sexy.
Yeah.
Poison Ivy never smiled. There's not a single photo of her smiling, ever.
Yeah.
And Lux was already over 6 foot tall, which is whatever, you know, however many meters or whatever. But and he had pumps on, you know, female shoes and glittery stretch pants and... The fact that they were, that you said, what are you? And it seemed their answer to be like, we're exactly what we are.
Yeah.
I've always loved that. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, that's why it's just a love of things like the gay community and artwork that comes out. Yeah. Tom of Finland and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. It all feels like the cramps of the fuzzy edge of many worlds that are joining.
Yeah.
The rough and tumble, rough, wild.
But also glammy.
Glammy, gay,
straight,
like it was,
wild and dangerous.
Yeah, like I've always been obsessed with the transitions of life where one thing ends and the next thing begins. Mm-hmm. Because it seems like that's where all the excitement is. That's the nutrients, whether it's in the ocean, you know, whether it's where I'm from, where there's snow on the mountains, and then at the base of the mountain, the desert begins. I live right there in the transition. And I see my obsession has never been the bricks, but the cement that holds it together, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I feel like the cramps are the fuzzy cement between all these scenes. And that started to become where I would get my inspiration.
Yeah.
It's like, who are you? I'm the nothing you see before you, right? Uh-huh. Whatever exists already, I'm this. If you look, I am where you expected to see nothing. Mm-hmm. Unsupply, undemand. Mm-hmm. You don't need me to be here. It's exactly why I'm here. Uh-huh. You know, I love that about music and art.
Yeah. You know? Some years back, you met up with Poison Ivy, and she showed you her and her late husband's record collection. How did that come about?
I had the absolute luxury of getting to know Lux Interior and Ivy, and playing shows with them. And God, you know, once
with what band did you?
Eagles of Death Metal, and then Cramps opened for Queens multiple times.
I didn't know that. Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, and Eagles opened up for the Cramps, and we had this really beautiful, whispery, conspiring relationship.
Yeah.
What? And you know, Lux would always talk very soft, and he would say, "You know what?" And he had this look on his face where I was like, "Oh my God, what the hell's going to happen?" It just. Of all the people I've had been blessed enough to play with or meet or just slam into and with that beautiful friction.
Yeah.
Knowing Lux and Ivy was just like a childhood dream.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Coming back to the Stooges, at some point you were able to digest them and you fell in love with Iggy Pop ever since. But when did that actually happen? So when did you...
It actually happened in Germany. So I, as a young, arrogant kid, once I realized that I was tuning guitars down and nobody else was doing that, when I realized that I was alone there and that we had something, some sound, you know, that was different than other people in Caius.
Yeah.
For many years, I didn't realize it at all.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think because I was so young and because I was so surprised that we were allowed to leave the desert to play, I think that first year or two, I was pretty cocky about it, honestly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 18 years old and 19 years old. And I, the moment I realized, oh my God, we sound different than everybody. So when you're young like that, you think you're doing something for the first time. And it's never been done before.
Yeah.
And in some cases, very rare, tiny cases, like tuning down, that's correct.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you start to hear more music. And in Caius, I didn't like to listen to other music because I was afraid to be influenced by someone else.
Yeah.
I wanted it to seem like it was just, what happens if I don't expose myself to too much?
Yeah.
What will I admit? I'll never have this chance again, you know? But then our sound man, Hutch, he really fucked me up. He he started playing me The Idiot and Lust for Life. And then and I was 19 years old and I'd never heard it.
Yeah.
And then he said, that dovetailed into the Stooges. And I said, oh, I heard them. But I'm talking about my 9 or 10 year old self. And I said, no, they're shit, you know. But then I listened to this Iggy... these two records.
Yeah.
And then I heard the Stooges and I lost my mind. And I really, it's one of the reasons I think I quit Caius.
Okay.
Actually, because I thought I need to, Caius felt like this beautiful thing that needed, if it was going to be preserved, it needed to be destroyed. But I felt like I couldn't grow in the confines of what Caius was at some point.
A similar impact, but earlier, the Misfits had on you, I guess. And especially their 1985 album, Legacy of Brutalities.
Right, it came out. Sure, it came out in 85.
Yeah.
But it was a compilation of their earliest, among their earliest recordings. And first of all, they'd done these recordings kind of by themselves, as was the case for many bands like Black Flag or, Minor Threat.
Yeah.
And the Misfits, they had their own labels because they couldn't be put out. No one would sign them, right? And so this very much like, I don't worry that other people don't like it. I just keep doing it.
Yeah.
You know? And that combination of Elvis, the darkness of the Doors.
Yeah.
When I got to the Misfits, that record, Legacy of Brutality, it's like Halloween every night. Right? And that just made me feel good. And the singing, Danzig's voice is just fucking...
It is. I mean,
nobody else has ever sounded like that.
No.
And it's such a... It owes so much to, Elvis and Roy Orbison. It owes all this stuff, but I don't care. It sounds unto itself and it's fucking incredible.
But did you like the Misfits also because you could draw a line from Elvis and Roy Orbison that you already liked
naturally?
To them?
Naturally. Yeah. It felt like what it is, the punk rock extremity, the fingertip of Elvis and Roy Orbison.
Yeah.
This dark, dirty fingernail. And what's not to love? It was punk rock that seemed like it was for men and women and all in between.
Yeah.
It didn't seem, hardcore music seemed like it was for boys, which I always thought was a bit of a mistake.
On television, you saw a documentary or something about punk rock, and there was a band in there called Social Distortion.
Another State of Mind. It's one of the great documentaries about punk rock.
Yeah.
And I love Chuck Berry, and I just saw Mike Ness as being, the long, dirty fingernail of Chuck Berry. Because that first Mommy's Little Monster, that was actually one of the first records I got, too. It's very, very early on.
Yeah.
It's Chuck Berry-ness, which I already love Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
And all that music, what it talks about was so unpopular. It was so for the kids. Yeah. It was so our music.
Yeah.
And all this stuff came out a little, I was really young, so I didn't get to see this. I didn't know if these people were dead or alive. I just assumed everyone was dead. Everyone else was fucking dead that I listened to. It's just, all music is made by dead people.
But you already mentioned that your brother was more into the wavy kind of things, the new wave stuff. The music that came out of a certain punk scene, maybe, but that wasn't punk. And I wonder if that was for some part interesting to yourself, because through a cover version the Queens did, I discovered the San Franciscan new wave or art punk band Romeo Void and their underground hit Never Say Never. How did you get to know about them?
To be honest, there was a movie called Reckless, and it was a song that was in this movie, and it was on the dance floor. And it was about an outcast kid in high school, and this kind of popular gal and whatever told this romantic story. But that song, I've always gravitated to just the chorus alone. I might like you better if we slept together. But there's something in your eyes that says maybe, and that's never. A line like that in such a catchy song spoke to me.
Yeah.
Because, when you're young, I think all you know is what you grew up with. And when you hear someone say something like that, I might like you better if we slept together. My first question was, are you allowed to say that? Is that okay? So you start, you're just pushing boundaries to see where they have cracks, where they break, where the windows open.
Yeah.
And you push and you push and you push and you push.
Yeah.
And now here I am still trying to find the next weakness to push and break through, you know.
Mm. You already mentioned the black flag, and well, I know that your high school friend and future Caius and Queen's bassist Nick Oliveri is known to be heavily into black flag.
Yeah.
Did you bond over black flag?
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to punk rock music, if you listen to music that was sort of just more fringy, there wasn't a lot of us.
Yeah.
And so we just, that was the only reason we, you knew people, but that was the reason we hung out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you realize there's kids in other towns in the desert that like this too, and you start playing music, and you start uniting the clans.
Mm-hmm.
And that would become a really big deal to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't want all of you. I just want some of you from every clique.
Yeah.
You know, we'll make a new clique. and yeah, it's so just happened to be that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've never given up on that.
But there's always a lot of talk about the doomy B-side of Black Flag's My War LP. And that is often cited as very influential on bands that later invented sludge metal, stoner rock, whatever. Did that album have a certain impact on you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a dark record. Yeah. Things like Rat's Eyes and shit like that, songs like that. And just My War.
Yeah.
I mean, you can hear the opening to My War, and if you play A Song for the Dead, you hear Dave Grohl tipping his hat to the... Oh, no, sorry, that's Slip It In. You Got a Boyfriend. So all those albums, Slip It In, which had the blue cover, and then My War had the red cover. It's like they're very almost like answers to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, great records.
In 1985, at the age of 12, you joined a band called Autocracy. How did that come about, and what kind of music did Autocracy play?
Well, we just played as fast as we could play. No bass player.
Yeah.
The guy Brant Bjork played bass or sang, but couldn't do both at the same time.
Okay. So,
and it was lots of screaming. It sounded probably closer to Discharge than anything that I could reference.
Yeah. And 2 years later, you founded a punk rock band at high school called Katzenjammer, one of those few German words that ended up in the Oxford Dictionary. Why Katzenjammer? How do you pronounce it, by the way?
Well, we pronounce it Katzenjammer, of course.
Katzenjammer, of course.
Yeah. Katzenjammer.
Katzenjammer.
You know, it's just a world away.
Yeah.
But because it meant a headache, and it felt like, oh, that's what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
And really, that was what became Caius. That's the same people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You were pretty much into punk back in the day. We got that. But what sound were you aiming for with that band?
Well, you know, what quickly became apparent is what I was calling punk wasn't just hardcore music, but it was being yourself music.
Yeah.
And so I think early on we probably sounded more original when it was Katzenjammer and when it was Autocracy than we did in the first incarnation of Caius.
Yeah.
Because by then we're so into the Misfits and all that we just sort of took that upon ourselves, you know? And I think as you do when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I see people in their 20s now that are like so much further along than I was.
Yeah.
But I was already touring the world at 22 as well, so I don't know.
Yeah. But there's a guy called Mario Lally. He's 7 years older than you and heralded as the godfather of desert rock, playing in bands like Across the River, Yawning Man, and later Fatso Jetson. What role does Mario play in your curriculum vitae?
Well, just about the time that we were Katzenjammer and starting to play parties that weren't just our age, but older kids too.
Yeah.
You know, realizing there were older kids having parties and we could play there was a big deal.
Yeah.
And
is it the generator parties?
Generator
the legendary
parties. And Mario used to have parties at his house, and everyone lived on their own. And I was 14 years old, 13 years old.
Yeah.
And, but he, you know, there's been a lot made of the generator parties and they were wonderful, but there was only one generator and Mario owned it. You know what I mean?
That was,
so who does he who is he to the desert scene? He's where it starts.
Yeah.
That was his idea.
Yeah.
I just was growing up and there were generator parties, and so I participated, but I didn't, you know, I would never, it would be wrong to give me credit or anyone in Caius credit for creating generator parties.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So Katzenjammer at some point changed their name and record an 8-track EP as Sons of Caius. Does it come from Sons of Cactus, by the way?
No.
Okay, good.
It was in a Dungeons and Dragons portfolio. Yeah. And I guess we're looking for a name that ideally didn't mean anything but what we were doing.
Mm. And it is a downtuned, groovy mix of desert rock or biker rock, if you will. It reminds me a little of early Soundgarden and Danzig and The Cult and maybe a little bit of Melvins.
Yeah.
But what did you aim for while writing these songs for the first EP?
I was a child.
Yeah. But those...
I didn't know about any of those bands because I hadn't got there. Yeah.
But do you see similarities now? Because the weird thing is that those bands that I just mentioned, they basically did somehow comparable sound, if you will,
We started to know of each other, and I'm sure they were on a similar search themselves.
Yeah.
And when I heard Soundgarden, I was like, wow, these guys are fucking amazing.
Yeah.
You know? And then I heard Nirvana, and the first thing, I went and saw Nirvana... And I'd already, the first time I really got exposed to Nirvana, all it did was I turned to one of the guys in Caius and was like, we need to write better songs.
All right. The first appearance of Queens of the Stone Age on record is a split EP with Caius for Man's Ruin Records in 1989. And Caius were often heralded as legitimate heirs of the riff-heavy, low-end, doomy sound of Black Sabbath. And on that very EP, Caius are actually covering Sabbath with Into the Void. Can you remember who made the choice to cover exactly that song?
It was Frank Kozik. I desperately didn't want to cover any Sabbath ever. But, you know, I was a young guy, and he said, you know what would be... From his perspective, he was saying, you know what would be cool if you covered the song Into the Void? And from my perspective, I was like, God damn it. And I thought he was saying, if you don't, we won't put this out, which he wasn't saying. So I could have said, no. I'm glad we did it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've come to love Sabbath, but at the time I was in Caius, I refused to listen to Sabbath.
Yeah.
Because there was a comparison, and I wanted to be... able to say I've never heard them and not be lying, I really started getting exposed to a lot more music by that time. You know, we made that recording, and that was our final recording, and I felt like that was our best recording ever. Yeah. That whole session. Hmm. I mean, it was mixed on mushrooms. That's not why, but it was just as free as it was us sounding our very best.
Yeah. When you came up with the sound for Queens of the Stone Age, you, for a while at least, named that style robot rock. Where did that stem from, and what were you seeking for? Who influenced you at that time, and when Caius split up and Queens of the Stone Age somehow got born?
Well, first of all, they were saying that we were part of like two or three bands like Sleep, Monster Magnet, Caius.
Fu Manchu, maybe. Yeah,
well, they were a little bit later.
Yeah.
But yes, them too. Yeah. Yes. And but it was the three of us that was like pushed together into this stoner rock, like a new thing, stoner rock.
Yeah.
And I guess I just wasn't in love with having someone lay a fucking blanket over you.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I suppose I should have... No, I'm glad I never did. I just didn't want to play into that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're trying to do something that sounds different, it's natural. The first thing someone does is put a label on it.
Yeah.
But it felt natural to kick against that and say, I'm not going to wear this, some stupid cape of a label.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to figure out something that sounded different that I hadn't yet heard.
Yeah.
And I started just really getting into repetition, droning repetition. And it reminded me of these cartoons that I'd watched as a kid where the house of tomorrow and like a machine will come out of the wall and sweep up something. Mm-hmm. But inevitably these machines break and they do a sick repetition.
Yeah. Yes.
And so for me, that was like, how do I find the sick repetition?
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to fucking dance, man.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of Caius, I was actually working at raves and like taking ecstasy and setting up lights and dancing all night long. And I felt like that the early, early techno music was like punk rock without guilt.
Yeah.
It's more fuck music.
You know? And more tribalistic maybe.
It's more tribalistic, more sexualized, more more inclusive of everybody.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just angry boys, you know?
Yeah.
It was... And it was another thing that was just ours, you know, it wasn't for everybody. It wasn't, you know, now there's no, it almost feels like mainstream is what everyone wants.
Yeah.
But that seems silly to me, you know.
During that time, certain songs for the Queens took shape during the Desert Sessions, and you worked with an illustrious company of musicians in those sessions. So let's stick to one certain song that is part of the... Third session, it's Nova. Ben Shepard from Soundgarden plays bass. Alfredo Hernandez from Caius plays drums. John McBain from Monster Magnet plays guitar. And Pete Stahl is singing. And Stahl used to be in a grungy alternative rock band named Wool back in the day. Caius did a split thing with Wool.
He was in Scream. He was with Dave Grohl.
He was in Scream. Yeah. And so Pete is or was a member in a couple of bands. I mean, Goatsnake also, for example.
Yeah, sure.
And he probably tour managed even more bands. And he's an avid music nerd. So what's your connection to Pete Stahl?
You know, I met, what we used to say, one of the greatest tours no one ever saw was Caius, this band Wool, and another band called The Obsessed.
Yeah.
And... you know, we just drove in a caravan, three vans. Mm-hmm. We were having to go into the supermarket and steal sandwiches because we were so...
hungry.
So hungry.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get paid based on who shows up, and nobody showed up to an entire West Coast tour.
Yeah.
There was like maybe 50 people in Seattle, and that was the most. And so, but that was okay because we were together.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like we'd done anything wrong. It just felt like people don't know.
Yeah.
And whether that's true or not, it doesn't matter if we felt like it was great. So getting to know like-minded outsiders,
mm-hmm.
that really, there was no expectation that this was going to go well.
Yeah.
That would have been outrageous to assume that our music was going to go anywhere.
There's a lot of somehow atonal, weirdly timed songs that came out of the Desert Sessions, and you carry on the torch with Queen songs like You Would Know, or These Aren't the Droids You're Looking For, or Spiders and Vinegaroons. In its freeform but dense sound, it reminds me somehow of the krautrock band Can, for example.
So that's what happened to me.
Okay.
First of all, Frank Kozik had the idea to do Desert Sessions. It wasn't my idea.
Uh-huh. Okay.
He said, man, you're not doing anything right now. Why don't you just, you know, take people out in the desert and jam? And I said, and then he said, you could call it like, you know, like the Desert Sessions or something and just do whatever. And that little thing that he said in passing, just my mind exploded because... I realized in Caius, we weren't allowed to jam with anyone else, or we weren't allowed to do, there's all these rules, too many fucking rules. And part of the reason I quit is because I had helped make this situation that had rules, and I'd seen there were nowhere to break it except to break it. Mm-hmm. So going to do Desert Sessions was a way to say, I'm not saying play with me forever.
Yeah.
I'm saying just a little.
Yeah.
I felt like a madam at a brothel.
Yeah.
Come fuck me for a little, just a little. I'll fuck you back. You can go on your fucking way, mm-hmm. you know? And it also, I had songs that I was afraid of, you know, you're insecure. Is this, yeah. And it was early kind of robotic repetition, yeah. Sick repetition. Yeah. And so being able to implement those as my ideas allowed me to try things with other people, mm-hmm. and almost like a safety net.
Yeah.
If you like it, it's my fault. If you hate it, it's his fault. No. No, it just allowed for us all to be ourselves, uh-huh. and have the musical safety to take a leap, fail, and it's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, after all, that's...
Yeah.
And so when you hear that stuff carry over from Desert Sessions to Queens, because you're hearing what I brung to the table, you know?
Yeah.
And I did that for years, like even playing Make It With You first because I was too scared to play it with Queens, you know?
Yeah. But as I mentioned, the crowd rock thing, is that something that you ever got into?
Okay, so I made the first Queens record.
Yeah.
And I said to Hutch, same motherfucker, who was my sound man, and who has always been an inspiration to me as an artist and a person.
Spiritual mentor.
And just as I mean, he's just such a...
Yeah.
And he's much, not much, he's you know, 9 years older than me.
Yeah.
And I paid Joe Barisi up front and was made the first Queens record.
Yeah.
And it was Alfredo on drums and I played everything else. Mm-hmm. And I was convinced that I've got it, something different. I've never heard anything like it before.
Okay.
Never.
Mm-hmm.
And Hutch listened to the record and he really enjoyed it.
Uh-huh.
But he looked at me and he goes, "Have you ever heard Can?" And I was like, "No, who's Can?" And I was like, once I heard Can, I was like, "You son of a bitch." Thankfully, of course. But you know, their repetition is different than mine, but their repetition is so beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, what's not to like when it comes to Can?
But so all the early Queen stuff and the Desert Sessions, they were...
I might have to go soon.
Yeah? Oh, okay.
I hate to say that, but
okay.
I'm enjoying speaking with you.
And yeah.
You know a lot of stuff, but we play in an hour.
Yeah. Okay, then let me ask you two last questions.
Yeah.
Quickly. Okay.
Yeah.
So the last time I've seen the Queens live was at the Velodrome here in Berlin, and it was on the tour for Villains, and you had an intro track that night, the Scat Brothers with their weirdly dark and kind of homoerotic disco rock song.
Not kind of homoerotic.
Walk the Night. So how did that one make your entrance hymn?
As I said, I've always loved the I've always had an admiration and a fondness for the gay community. I just, you know... I love the freedom. I love the taboo that's there. I admire how they've come together and worked so hard. And there's so much great music that comes out of the gay scene.
Mm-hmm.
And Walk the Night, like the Doors or the Misfits or the techno music or the drone stuff I was playing.
Yeah.
It was this sexually taboo stomp through the underworld.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess a lot of the time, in writing my own music, I just ask, what's the type of band I want to be in? What do I want to hear?
Mm-hmm.
And the Scat Brothers on That Walk the Night is part of that tapestry for me.
Yeah.
It's a dirty little disco bitch. And I just, Walk the Night, that's what I want to do, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And as your recent intro, you picked Charlie Chaplin as a Tramp by jazz singer Peggy Lee. How did that make the cut?
Well, it's Smile, actually.
Smile.
By Peggy Lee. Yeah, it's Smile.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know,
then
in the last many years, I have been forced to participate or chose to participate in some very difficult ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
But the beauty is and when people pass away or you have your heart broken or you get sick, when it doesn't kill you, you feel so in rapture with appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not dead yet, you know? Or the realization that I get to love people even when they're not here, things like that, which are revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I need to remember to do is smile.
Mm-hmm.
And so we walk out more as a reminder to me than anything else to the song Smile by Peggy Lee.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I Enjoy that, thank you.
Liebe Zuhörerinnen, Zuhörer und alle irgendwo dazwischen, wenn ihr auf dem Laufenden bleiben wollt oder einfach neugierig seid, wie ich mit welchem meiner Gäste in was für einer Situation gesprochen habe, solltet den Instagram-Kanal des Visions oder Mint Magazins abonnieren oder meinen persönlichen unter Jan Schwarzkamp. Sehr gerne alle drei. Bleibt gesund und dem Podcast treu und dann hoffentlich bis zur nächsten Episode von der Soundtrack meines Lebens, euer Jan Schwarzkamp.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.